I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Today, more qualified praise for the new Iraqi constitution. The leaders of Iraq's largest Shiite political party say the constitution, which was signed yesterday, is a huge achievement. But like other Iraqis, the leader of the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq also thinks the document isn't perfect. On the line from Baghdad is Sewell Chan. He writes for the Washington Post Foreign Service. And Sewell, we understand that the main objection of leaders is that an unelected body, the Governing Council, approved the Constitution. Do ordinary Iraqis feel this way?
Hi, Robin. It's nice to be on Here and Now. Based on my conversations with a number of Iraqis yesterday and asking them about their responses to the signing of the Constitution, I think the objection you cite is one among several. The U.S. occupation authorities have said for a while that direct elections aren't yet possible in Iraq because of logistical problems, the lack of a legal infrastructure for elections, and frankly, the absence of an accurate census for some 20-something years. The Iraqis that I talked to yesterday seemed more concerned about, you know, whether this constitution is actually meaningful. It is a temporary document. It's supposed to govern the country from the time that American officials turn over authority and political sovereignty on June 30th until elections are held next year. But those elections could bring about a lot of changes. And even political leaders today are saying that the document could be changed as soon as June 30th. That's not far from now at all.
Right. Well, and even though many haven't seen the most haven't seen the Constitution, they did have opinions about some of the ideas expressed in the Bill of Rights. Tell us about those. I'm thinking, for instance, of freedom of religion. One woman commented to you on that.
Yeah, the Bill of Rights is really sort of a key part of the document. One woman that I spoke to said that she, as a Chaldean Christian, really appreciated the idea that freedom of conscience would be protected in Iraq, even though the Constitution does say that Islam is will be the official religion of the country. It gets mixed reactions for members of the country's large Shiite majority. It's a breath of relief to have their ability to practice their religion openly. For many of the Sunni Muslims, a group that has constituted Iraq's political elite for many decades now, it's a source of some uncertainty and apprehension.
Looking at another concept, someone spoke to you about freedom for women, rights for women, and I was interested to read this jewelry store owner said, you know, women have suffered long enough.
You know, I talked to several men, actually, interestingly, who said 25%, that doesn't make any sense. You know, women are more than 50% of Iraq's population. And I thought that was quite interesting, actually. I'm no expert on sort of gender relations in Iraq by any stretch, but I think it's interesting that a lot of ordinary folks are welcoming increased participation by women. You know, it's interesting that originally the document was supposed to contain a goal of 40%, and now that's been reduced to 25%.
Right.
And really a goal, there's nothing sort of obligating the new government to do that, but for a lot of people it's very nice to have that in the new government's founding document.
Yeah, a provision that women will make up at least 25% of Iraq's new legislature. Well, Sewell, thank you very much.
Thank you, Robin.
Now the job is getting the Constitution out to people so they can see it. Sewell Chan writes for the Washington Post Foreign Service. He spoke to us from Baghdad.
Well, even as some Iraqis try to create a new country, U.S. and Iraqi officials continue trying to unearth the roots of the ongoing insurgency in Iraq. No single names brought up more frequently than Abu Musab Zarqawi, a 37-year-old Jordanian terrorist blamed for dozens of attacks and suicide bombings. He has a $10 million price on his head. Reporters who attend coalition briefings in Baghdad say Zarqawi's name comes up just about every day. But is Zarqawi the mastermind, the supervillain he's cracked up to be? Joining us on the line from Amman, Jordan, is Sebastian Rotella, Paris bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. And Sebastian, U.S. officials seem to have reason for focusing on Zarqawi. They point particularly to a letter he wrote confiscated from an Al-Qaeda courier that takes responsibility for no less than 25 attacks in Iraq.
And certainly Zarqawi is considered a dangerous terrorist and has a presence in a lot of places, probably including Iraq. But there is a bit of a debate about the insistence with which the U.S. officials and some Iraqi leaders continuously point to Zarqawi as a kind of a mastermind and take that letter, if in fact he wrote it, at its word, where he says he's committed 25 suicide attacks. That would be just about all the bombings that have happened in Iraq of significance since the fall. And there's, you know, different points of view as to whether the insurgency is more complicated, more nuanced, more ambiguous than that, whether in particular this emphasis on foreigners distorts a reality in which loyalists of Saddam Hussein and former Ba'athists are, you know, play a much more important role in the insurgency overall and in the suicide attacks as well. So there's a lot of ambiguity there, and there isn't a great deal of evidence that's been made public anyway that would confirm the idea that Zarqawi has been sort of a super chief ordering all these attacks.
Well, if the suggestion is that Zarqawi's been hyped a bit, if you will, why would coalition commanders do that?
There's a reluctance, I think, to acknowledge the extent to which the insurgency is really driven by Iraqis. But again, the reality seems more complicated. Zarqawi is something somewhat distant from al-Qaeda, something of a competitor with al-Qaeda. And foreigners may be playing a role, but it seems very difficult from everything we're seeing on the ground that foreign terrorists could function there without all kinds of help from the locals, from the people, particularly former members of the security forces of Saddam Hussein, who, from everything we hear, are the people who are in many of these attacks doing the reconnaissance, providing the infrastructure, sometimes providing the explosives.
How do other intelligence agencies see Zarqawi?
I think, in general, there's a perception, particularly among the Europeans, who have dealt with him quite a lot, because there's been a number of frustrated or foiled plots in Paris, London, Germany, that connect back to him. They see him as a significant figure who's with the demise of some al-Qaeda figures and others having gone underground, who's sort of been stepping up and has become more active. But I think they also, in general, the Europeans tend to be, and some Arabs as well, whether in law enforcement or analysts, tend to be more cautious about singling out an individual as being the person in charge. I think there's a view that the U.S. tends to like to put up one person and say, this is the top bad guy. I think the Europeans and Arabs see the networks as more loose, more anarchic, less structured.
Sebastian, what's your sense of how well the coalition understands who's causing the violence in Iraq? You think of bombings like that immense series of bombings last week in which more than 270 people died.
I mean, I think it varies on who you're talking about. I think, again, the political leadership of the coalition has emphasized the Zarqawi letter and the role of Zarqawi and al-Qaeda-type organizations. But if you go out, as I just did, I just spent 3 weeks in Iraq, and go out to bases and talk to the commanders, I think, and people in intelligence, I mean, you have a sense that there is a more nuanced understanding of the complexities of the insurgency, and I think particularly the commanders on the ground, again, see it as essentially an Iraqi phenomenon with some role of foreigners, but it's different than it's portrayed. I mean, those incredibly bloody attacks against the Shiite shrines certainly had the style of that we're accustomed to with al-Qaeda, you know, two simultaneous attacks in two cities, but not all the attacks have been like that. And there isn't a lot of evidence out there. I mean, certainly that's been made public. It's a pretty crazy, violent, chaotic environment in which to do the kinds of investigations, the meticulous investigations that terrorism usually requires.
Sebastian Rotella, Paris bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times, joined us from Amman, Jordan. Sebastian, thanks.
Thanks very much.
There was a rare sight in Syria yesterday. Activists gathered in downtown Damascus demanding reform, unfurling a banner that read Freedom for Prisoners of Opinion and Conscience. The group was small, maybe 20 or 30, outnumbered by Syrian plainclothes policemen. Within minutes, the protesters were arrested and taken away. They were later released, but today one of their leaders vowed to continue to press for democracy in Syria. Well, joining us now from Damascus is Kim Hattas. She's a reporter for the BBC. And Kim, you were there yesterday. In fact, you were briefly detained. What happened? What did it look like?
We were expecting a larger number, about 200. The organizers were expecting at least 200 people to show up. But over the last few days before the event, several people had been called in to the police station to be questioned by intelligence, by the police. So it was an obvious attempt by the authorities to try to pressure the organizers to cancel the sit-in. That didn't happen. At least 20 or 30 people showed up. At some point, the police told the protesters that they should go home or face prison. The protesters said they weren't afraid to go to prison, and that's when they started taking them away to the police station. Now, in the kerfuffle, several journalists were detained as well, very briefly, including myself, but I have to stress it was a very brief detention of the sort that, you know, happens all over the world every day. A U.S. diplomat was also very briefly detained, we understand. We were released within an hour. We were given a cup of tea, a cup of coffee. It was all rather civil.
Well, what happened as it was happening? I mean, did passerbyers know what was going on? Was there chanting?
No, there was nothing. There was no chanting. Nobody said anything. It was a peaceful sit-in. And really, they didn't have time to do anything. When they put up their banner, it was torn by the intelligence officers who were there rather quickly. They didn't chant any slogans. They really didn't have time to do anything. And they were outnumbered by far by the intelligence and by the riot police. Mm. So it was really almost impossible to tell there was a sit-in going on unless you knew that it was supposed to happen.
Well, what do you think the impact will be? We know that President Bashar Assad is said to be taking steps to loosen the controls put in place by his dictator father. In January, more than 100 political prisoners were released by President Assad. Is this kind of an activist moment so unheard of in Syria? Is this expected to have any effect?
Well, I think that people in Syria are becoming bolder and bolder. Activists like the ones who were at the protest yesterday, other activists, other intellectuals, people are speaking out. People are making it clear in Damascus, in Syria, that they want reform, that they want more freedom. So definitely something is moving. It's still unclear what the authorities want, what they're going to do with it. Yes, President Bashar al-Assad has promised more reform. He still has to live up to these promises. He's released political prisoners. He's also detained more people. So it's a little bit one step forward, one step backward at the moment. But certainly I think that activists who were released yesterday thought it was positive that they were released so shortly after they were detained and have not been charged.
Kim, very briefly, this protest was on the 41st anniversary of the Ba'ath Party's seizure of power in Syria. Of course, we've watched over the last year the fall of the Ba'ath Party in neighboring Iraq. The impact of the fall of the Ba'ath Party in Iraq on Syria, just briefly.
Well, certainly, although party members and officials here like to stress the fact that the two Ba'ath parties in Iraq and Syria are rivals, certainly the fact that one Ba'ath party is gone does leave Syrian Ba'athists to reflect alone on how much longer they can survive without embracing change. When people in Syria are starting to feel freer and are starting to feel more, as I said, bolder, and are starting to question themselves the role and the future of the Ba'ath party.
Mm. Kim Gaddis, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Kim Gaddis, reporter for the BBC, speaking to us from Damascus, Syria.
Just ahead, the final word, for now, on long-term hormone replacement therapy and heart disease.
And later, how outsourcing is affecting a small community in Western Virginia.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Medical science completed a very large, very public about-face last week when the last remaining group of women in a large clinical trial were advised to stop taking hormone replacement therapy to protect against heart disease. Dr. Jacques Rousseau, project director of the Women's Health Initiative at National Institutes of Health, told the women that estrogen alone therapy did not prevent heart attacks and, in fact, slightly increased the risk of stroke. 2 years ago, the same researchers made a very similar announcement about combined estrogen and progestin therapy. The changing and at times contradictory medical advice has been a nightmare for many women. So to bring some clarity, we're joined by our regular health columnist, Judy Foreman. Hi, Judy.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Let's start with this latest news. Postmenopausal women taking just estrogen tablets.
Right.
And what did the research show?
It showed basically that that did not protect against heart disease, nor did it increase the risk, we have to say. And the hope had been that it would protect. And it slightly raised the risk of stroke. That is about 8 more strokes for every 10,000 women taking estrogen alone every year. That's not huge, but it was enough that in the context of no heart benefit and with zillions of women taking it, they felt they had to stop the study early.
What did this study also find about breast cancer?
This was very surprising. They found it did not increase the risk of breast cancer. For years, that has been many women's biggest concern, and justifiably, because other data showed that there was an increased risk. Why this did not show an increased risk in breast cancer, nobody knows, and they'll be figuring it out in the next couple of months.
So once again, women are trying to parse this information. Now, we should stress this was a warning about long-term hormone therapy. Is it now clear that most women should not take hormone therapy long-term?
I think the researchers would say, yes, that is clear. There are a lot of gynecologists and some women who also feel like they can't live without it. But the research does imply that.
And definitely don't take it long-term for heart benefits, because those aren't there.
That's exactly right. In the past, that was the reason doctors were prescribing this like crazy. I mean, there were 90 million prescriptions a year way back a few years ago before these studies came out. And the main justification was that hormones protect your heart. That is very clearly not true. The first study that came out 2 years ago, that was women on the combined therapy. This latest thing was just women on estrogen alone. And those are women who've had a hysterectomy. They don't need the additional progesterone to protect their uterus. I've talked to a number of gynecologists around the country who say that their business is booming once they get a reputation for being, I don't want to say more sympathetic, but likely to give hormones to women who say they just can't live without them.
The last time this announcement was made, women just cut their hormone replacement therapy, stopped it on a dime, which doctors tell us is not the right thing to do.
That's right. The advice is to cut back very, very slowly, like over weeks and months.
But what about women who, as you said, can't? What if they have to use it?
Well, I think, you're sort of getting at something really important. I mean, for the here and now menopausal symptoms like hot flashes and night sweats, the stuff that really drives women crazy, even the researchers from this study, the Women's Health Initiative, are saying, yes, take it, but take it for as low a dose as will help and for a short amount of time.
What is that short amount of time?
For some people it's years. For some people it's 6 months. For some people it's 2 or 3 years. I think people sort of go on it and then try to taper off. And if they can succeed getting off, they stay off. If they can't, they go back on. Mm. A number of gynecologists also suggest other ways of taking estrogen. And this has been much, much, much less studied. But some women swear by having creams or patches to get the estrogen transdermally, through the skin instead of orally or transvaginally. There are reasons to think this might work better. But the data isn't there as much as it is with the Women's Health Initiative, with the pill form.
Mm. And Judy, how does this happen? I mean, we've discussed this, we discussed this 2 years ago, but how does this happen that something is so touted and then, whoops, it's like a rug being pulled out from under you?
Well, it makes more sense than it might seem. Estrogen, in theory, is very good for your blood vessels. It helps keep them open. But the main data that researchers had until these two studies came out was from observational studies, which means women join the study and they say, all right, I want to take estrogen, and somebody else says, I won't. The big benefit of this Women's Health Initiative was women were randomized. They couldn't choose themselves whether to take hormones or not. And that makes a huge difference because, in general, it's more educated women and wealthier women who take the hormones. So that they may just be healthier in the first place. And that may be why the observational studies showed a benefit and the randomized studies did not.
You mentioned different ways of taking an estrogen. Are there different forms?
Yes, there are lots of different forms. One is called 17-beta estradiol. And that actually comes in, you make it in your body when you're premenopausal, and you also can get it from yams and soy when they're processed in the lab. And that form is thought to be bioidentical, in other words, exactly the same as the estrogen you make in your own body. There's not a lot of data on whether this is better or worse or as safe or not as safe as Premarin, which is the pill form that comes from horse urine. Aside from the whole animal rights objection to horse urine as a form of medication for women, many gynecologists think that the 17-beta estradiol would be better for women. But I have to say the data is very skimpy on this point.
Mm-hmm. What are some other things about the Women's Health Initiative study that we should know so that women can make their own educated decision as to how to take the information in?
Yeah, I mean, it was a very carefully done study. It was good in many ways. But as gynecologists point out, it did have some flaws. One of them is that the average age of women in the study was 63, and most of those women had not been taking estrogen or estrogen plus progestin before the study started, which means they were 13 years into menopause with no hormones. And that may be physiologically very different from a woman who takes hormones right at age 50 or when menopause happens and never sort of has that big dip. This is not proven. This is not, you know, really solid in terms of lab data, but there are good theoretical reasons to think that it might be quite different.
Well, as usual, Judy, gather all your information and then talk to your doctor, right?
Yes.
Here Now's regular health columnist Judy Foreman. For more on her column, visit our website, here-now.org.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, U.S. presidential politics as seen from abroad. We speak to foreign editors about the U.S. election campaign.
And actor William Dafoe on his new film, The Reckoning. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Clintwood, Virginia has had its share of economic woes. There's been the decline of coal mining, the closure of textile plants, and now the departure of Travelocity. The internet travel giant opened in Clintwood in 2001, creating 250 call center jobs and signing a six-year lease on a building abandoned during the dot-com bust. But now Travelocity is leaving, and to save money, about $10 million in the first year alone, it's going to outsource jobs to India. Charles Hay is head of the Industrial Development Authority in Dickinson County, Virginia, where Clintwood is located. And Charles, Clintwood already has the highest unemployment rate in Virginia. How are people there reacting to this news?
Very disappointed. We are very disappointed that Travelocity has decided to take their jobs offshore. We feel like we have an excellent workforce here in Dickinson County, and they've done an excellent job for Travelocity. And the people in Dickinson County are very disappointed to see us lose an employer that was employing 250 people.
Well, and Travelocity says it lost $55 million last year and that it has to do this to save the company and save other jobs in other places. What's going to happen to the 250 Travelocity employees?
We're working very, very hard to get another company to come in to replace Travelocity, and hopefully those people will have an opportunity to get a job with another employer. Mm-hmm. From the time that we heard about Travelocity closing, we've been working very hard with the local officials, regional officials, and state and federal officials to try to get somebody in the building as soon as possible, hopefully even before Travelocity leaves, to get an opportunity back for those people to get a job.
But, you know, Charles, if you bring in another company, and let's say it's a call center or another large outside company, can you trust that they'll stay and that those jobs won't be outsourced?
You know, in the economic development field, it's very hard to tell when you're talking to someone how long they're going to be with you, but we have to keep working. We can't just give up and say, well, we're just not going to try to get any more companies to come in, because hopefully we'll get somebody in that will be longer term and be a good long-term employer for Dickinson County.
I know that also the county is trying to produce new crops, if you will, things like new technology, and keep it in the town.
That's correct. Dickinson County has been very aggressive in working toward getting ahead of the rest of the country or the rest of the counties in the state to try to attract new industries, new innovations for or technology that we hope that will be beneficial in the future.
Yeah, build the infrastructure there. I also understand that people are bottling jams from the country, turning one of the old homes in Clintwood over into a museum for a great blues legend, do I understand?
Yes, that is correct. Ralph Stanley is a truly a legend for Dickinson County. He's done an excellent job in the bluegrass music field, and we hope that the museum in Clintwood and the Country Music Trail that's being developed will be an asset to tourism in Dickinson County. We've been working on tourism for a long time to help diversity of our economy, and we hope that that will be truly a long-term source of tourism that will not be shipped offshore. So that's very positive.
Keep it organic. But that reminds me, what do you think of people like the head of the President's Economic Council or New York Times columnist Tom Friedman, who say that this is the benefit of outsourcing, that it forces Americans to do what they do best, which is come up with new economies?
Well, you know, for Dickinson County, it's not helping our economy any by taking these jobs offshore. You know, in some parts, you know, they may be right, but I don't think that their statement fits Dickinson County.
Right, you're not feeling it there. Actually, we hear that some of the things people say about that concept can't be repeated on public radio.
Well, that's probably true.
Yeah. Well, Charles Hay, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Charles Hay, Chairman of the Industrial Development Authority in Dickinson County, Virginia.
The campaign for the presidency is already underway, with President Bush and Senator John Kerry already going at each other. And, of course, their supporters are lending their voices to the rising political chorus. But some say the president has an advantage because he also has members of his cabinet, with all the stature that implies, speaking on his behalf, which is why some are suggesting John Kerry appoint a shadow cabinet. We're joined by Chris Sprigman, a fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
What's a shadow cabinet?
Well, shadow cabinet is an institution that you find in Britain and Australia. It's a group of ministers, shadow ministers, put together by the opposition party to shadow the real cabinet ministers, to criticize their policies, and also to present to the electorate policies that the opposition would like to put into place if they're elected.
Parallels precisely the members of the actual cabinet.
Well, it doesn't have to, but often it does. In the UK, the institution is actually quite elaborate. You could propose and actually put into place here in the U.S. something more streamlined, pick the maybe six or seven most vital cabinet secretaries and shadow them.
Why?
Kerry's got a number of problems. He's got 8 months that he has to keep the attention of the American people on his candidacy, and that's going to be difficult for a couple of reasons. First of all, President Bush has all the money. He has over $100 million available to him at the moment. The president also has the bully pulpit of the presidency. He has the power of incumbency and the entire apparatus of the executive branch, the political appointees in his cabinet, to help make his case. John Kerry is, at the moment, standing not entirely alone, but he's standing more or less alone. The shadow cabinet would give him a way to organize what the Democrats want to do if they were to come into the presidency and to explain to the American people how a Kerry administration would look different from the Bush administration.
Yeah, well, Kerry's not completely bereft of funds, of course. After the Democratic convention, he'll get $75 million in federal funds and catch up a bit. But presidential candidates have always had advisors, foreign policy advisors, economic advisors, and so on.
Right.
That's not enough?
First of all, it's a long time between now and the convention, and Kerry doesn't have the money to respond to Bush's air war now. By the time Kerry gets to the convention, he could be seriously wounded.
But how would that change by having a shadow cabinet, Chris?
Well, it's novel, first of all. Mm. And think back to 1994 and the Republicans taking control of both houses of Congress. What they did was they proposed something called a contract with America, and they laid out in a very programmatic way what it was they wanted to do. And that, whether you disagree or agree with the policies in that document, it elevated the debate. It focused the American people on the Republicans' prescription for what they thought was wrong and what to do about it. This shadow cabinet would be similar. It would gather in people, notable people, who are expert in, for example, law for the Attorney General or labor for the Labor Department. And it would endow them, unlike mere surrogates, it would endow them with the presumptive right to a job. I mean, they don't really have a right to a job, but they'd be the favorite. The presidential candidate would be endowing them with some of his credibility early.
You know, members of a president's cabinet sometimes have a falling out with the boss. Witness former Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill. Couldn't that happen in the middle of a presidential campaign with a member of the shadow cabinet?
Yeah, I'm not saying this strategy is without risk, but I think the risk may be worth taking. It helps build the party's bench. It helps promote people who haven't had senior positions before, who for some reason or another have expertise or a real talent for communicating policy. And that's a function that shadow cabinets have played in other countries, and we should be thinking about that as well.
Chris Brigman, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Chris Brigman is a fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org.
Still to come, dig out those old 45s. They could be worth big bucks to record fanatics. We enter the world of record collecting.
You're listening to Here and Now.
The first report this winter in New York seemed like a freak accident. A woman walking her dog was killed when she and her pet were electrocuted by a stray current in the street. Then one dog was killed and others severely shocked by stray currents in Boston. Pet supply stores sold out of protective booties for dogs. And yesterday, 14 Bostonians testified at a hearing at Boston City Hall, describing the agony of watching their pet be shocked and complaining that they received late, little, or no response from the local electric company, NSTAR. Walter Salvi, NSTAR's manager of community relations, responded, blaming the problem on other construction workers on city streets.
The incidents that we heard about today are not the failure of NSTAR Electric to maintain its electric system. We are unable to control, and we should not have to accept responsibility for conditions beyond our control and knowledge.
Well, joining us on the line is John Toner. He and his dog were both electrocuted in Boston, and he attended yesterday's hearing. John, while the debate continues about who's at fault, what happened?
Took my dog for a walk, as I do every day. I almost got to my house when all of a sudden Blue froze and started wailing. So I thought he had hurt his paw, and I reached down to try and look and see if there was glass or something caught in it, and he bit my hand. And then I lost my balance, so I put my hand down on the manhole cover, and then I got shocked. Mm-hmm. And then realizing what was happening to him, I attempted to pick him up, and I got paralyzed from the electricity again, and he bit me again, and this went on two or three times before I was able to move him off the current that he was on.
What kind of dog is Blue?
He's a German Shepherd mix.
So he's a big dog, too?
He's 65 pounds.
Yeah. What happened then?
The paramedics came, and they treated me for the dog bites, but they offered to take me to the hospital, but not the dog, and you know, I could see that he was still shaking uncontrollably. I wasn't going to leave him, so I secured a ride to the Angel Memorial. And
Angel Memorial is the animal hospital here in the Boston area. How is Blue?
He walks with a limp now, and he ties very easily. I used to walk him for over an hour every day, and now I notice after about 15 minutes he seems exhausted. So
this is what a lot of the dog owners said, that if their dog survived, they're not the same. And you found out what others did. It's very difficult to get the dog away from the current.
The only analogy I can draw to it is it's like Superman with kryptonite. I couldn't move him. I remember it still wasn't registering in my head that I was getting shocked, and I was saying, I used to be able to pick him up. I wonder what happened.
Yeah. We hear in reports that the poor woman in New York who couldn't move her dog, also no one could help her because they would also be electrocuted, and she died. So you were actually pretty lucky.
Yeah. I thank the good Lord every day that we're both still here.
What are you going to do now with Blue? As you walk, what are you thinking about?
You know, just to see him limp, it just breaks my heart. I've had him for about 13 years. And, you know, it's been a tough while because I had another German Shepherd also, and he died suddenly in November. And so, you know, just to look at him and know that he's probably, you know, never going to be the same, it really hurts.
Yeah. Well, John, even though this incident was, you know, horrendous for you, they are relatively isolated. Are you taking precautions when you walk with Blue now?
Oh, absolutely. We absolutely won't walk him over any metal. I won't do it.
Well, John Toner, thank you.
Okay.
And give our best to Blue.
I will do that.
John Toner, he and his dog Blue survived an electrocution on the streets of Boston.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Many in our audience, but not all, I fear, will remember the special aura of a petroleum-based product, made of vinyl to be specific, known as a record album. They don't sell them much anymore in this digital age of CDs, but to some, the special sound, the special feel, even the clunky size of a record has magic, attracting a certain type of music fan who'd gladly travel, oh, say, 3,000 miles to get their hands on an obscure B-side by some long-forgotten German rock band. This type of hardcore record fan is fondly depicted in the book and movie High Fidelity.
I own this store called Championship Vinyl. It's located in a neighborhood that attracts the bare minimum of window shoppers. I get by because the people make a special effort to shop here. Mostly young men who spend all their time looking for deleted Smith singles and original, not re-released underline, Frank Zappa albums.
Well, now die-hard record fans are profiled in the new book, Vinyl Junkies, Adventures in Record Collecting. Brett Milano is the book's author and is himself an avid collector. We recently caught up with Brett at a used record store called Looney Tunes in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Brett Milano, when you wander into a record store full of vinyl albums, what are you experiencing? What's going on in your mind and heart and head?
If you are standing here in a record store, a used record store surrounded by vintage vinyl, I bet you that you're just like dying to reach inside one of those sleeves, pull out the record and see what the label looks like and see what the vinyl looks like. There's just something tactile about it. It just has more soul in some way.
Yeah, it's the jumping little record I want my jockey to play. Roll over Beethoven, I gotta hear it again today. You know my temperature.
And it's also the excitement of knowing that there's something I never realized I had to own that I'm about to realize I have to own. And 5 minutes later, I will also own it.
You look around on the walls here, Elvis Costello album, Brian Eno album, all the big square vinyl albums. You noted this. Tell me about it. Why did you get excited when you looked at that?
Well, this is an album by the Hombres called Let It Out, Let It All Hang Out. And the song itself is just one of those great demented garage rock records from the 60s. And just knowing that there might be like as many as 11 other songs that just might be that depraved is just makes my day.
No parking by the sewer sign, hot dog, my razor broke, water dripping up the spout, but I don't care, let it all hang out.
Are you going to find the Hombres Let It Out, Let It All Hang Out on CD?
I don't think it is, and it won't matter because I'm probably going to take the vinyl home today.
Does vinyl sound better than the highly technological compact disc?
There's the $64,000 question for you. There is something about the needle scraping against those grooves that produces a sound that CDs do not produce. And some people do prefer that, including some people that I talk to that are in the CD business also prefer vinyl.
Raining inside a big brown moon. How does that mess your baby up leg? Eating a Reuben sandwich with sauerkraut. Don't stop now, baby, let it all hang out. Let it all hang out.
Why does someone become obsessed with collecting records? In the book, you even say that some wise psychiatrists have determined that people who collect may not have as much serotonin to soothe their brains as other people. What's it all about?
Well, according to the ones I talked to, there is a serotonin deficiency, which actually causes a lot of things. It causes you maybe to be an artist, maybe to be a gambler, maybe to be a collector. And I found that a lot of people that are collectors who do love music and file it away are also creative in a lot of other ways. There's a lot of musicians involved. I talked to Robert Crumb, the famous comic artist. And whatever drives them to collect is also related to, I think, what drives them to be creative. So that's part of it. And also part of it is just a love for music and just that sort of your first experience, whether it was hearing the Beatles on the radio or whatever it was, just sort of created this trademark experience in you that you go through life looking to recreate.
Now, this is an album that I've certainly owned, bought when it first came out. Bob Dylan's Bringing It All Back Home. And it does. It kind of brings up a whole world. This is Dylan, first time there was any electric music on any Dylan album.
Look at this. This is the mono copy. This is the one that I'm told is the one that you need to have, because first of all, there's this little indent around the label right below where it says Columbia, which means that's a first pressing, and that's the way they pressed it the first time around.
Wow, this is a first edition.
And also that it is a mono mix, which a lot of people will say is the purer one, the one with more oomph to it. And also for me, part of the appeal is just knowing that it was part of this record, just by virtue of being the actual copy from the 60s, was part of the whole 60s cultural thing. I mean, who knows what sort of college campuses or radical enclaves this record was played in.
$7.99 for first pressing Bob Dylan, bringing it all back home, mono edition. Not bad. In the book, there's amazing characters, Brett. Some of them with thousands and even tens of thousands of albums. Talk about Peter Buck of R.E.M., guitarist for R.E.M.
Peter Buck is a big hero to a lot of people in the collecting world, because aside from making great records himself, he is a collector. And he did, in fact, work in a record store before R.E.M., but he worked in a record store after R.E.M. started becoming popular, just because he loved being around records and he loved selling them to people. And if you talk to him, he can give you a great pitch and tell you about what records you need to go out and buy. And he even did that to me. Told me about a record by a Texas band called Louie and the Lovers that I had to go out and find somewhere.
You say you had to go out and find it somewhere. In the book, you talk about going on a quest to find a solo album by the drummer for Cream, Ginger Baker.
Yes.
An obscure masterpiece called Adani?
Etunde. It's actually a 45. It's a single that he did credited to the Ginger Baker Drum Choir, and came out after Cream, and for some reason it's never been on the albums, it's never been reissued. It's this beautiful sort of four-minute mess of chanting and drumming. That's all it is. And to me, it was just this really triumphant, really sensual sound on this record, the African drumming and the women singing. All right, here we have 101 Strings Play Hits written by the Beatles. And a record like this is just an accident of pop culture. This is so beautifully wrong. That is the reason why somebody might want to hear it today.
This is why people collect, isn't it? There's something sort of joyfully nuts about it all, for one thing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, just to know that whoever the guy that decided to score Eleanor Rigby for Marimbas back in whenever it was, 1970, okay. And who would have thought? I mean, I'm sure he forgot about it by dinner that day. And yet, here we are, digging it up all over again.
So, Brett, just to finish up, what's your holy grail at the moment?
It changes from week to week. I mean, I have been known to spend months hunting down. For example, there was a Motown album recorded by Soupy Sales with the cream of the Motown session musicians actually backing up Soupy. And again, a record that's so right it's wrong, I just had to own it. Currently, I'm on the hunt for a band from the 60s called The Critters, who had a wonderful hit single called The Younger Girl, a Love and Spoonful song. They recorded after that hit. A couple years later, they did a couple of albums for an audiophile label owned by a guy named Enoch Light. They were sort of a stereo demonstration kind of hoopla crossed with their vocal 60s pop blend. And I hear these records are wonderful, and I also hear that they're nowhere to be found. So I'm hoping that doesn't turn out to be the case.
Any listeners out there with any clues, get in touch with us. Brett Milano, thank you. And thank you for a wonderful book, Vinyl Junkies, Adventures in Record Collecting.
You see this guy? This guy's in love with you. Yeah, I'm in love.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. By the way, we've already got an email. Thank you, Hilton Evans. Earlier, I said a man and his dog were electrocuted. Thankfully, they weren't, because they would have been killed. They survived electric shocks.
As always, we do welcome your thoughts on our program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or you can call our listener line and leave a message at 617-358-0397, 617-358-0397.
Please tell us how to pronounce your name and tell us the town you're from.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again here and now.
They say you think I'm fine.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.